Thank you for joining in this driving tour of historic Pleasant View. Pleasant View is celebrating her 150th birthday this year in the year of 2001, and we are celebrating by providing you these sights and true stories and recollections from an earlier time. This is a driving tour, and we are going by private properties this day, so we ask you to remember that and make this a driving tour. After you participate today, we invite you to go home and talk to your families and your friends and your neighbors and start your own collections of sights and memories that can last for years to come. Our first stop today will be at the Ellis Home. This is located at 480 West Alberta Drive, directly across from the New City offices. This pioneer home is tucked behind the modern home that sits on the corner. This home was built for Frederick Ellis's second wife, Sarah Jane Ellis. The brick was provided by her father, James Barker, and Will Hickenlooper is credited as the builder. Sarah Jane and her children lived here and worked this farm. Frederick, who was a paper hanger and a painter, lived most of his time in North Ogden with his other family. But during planting season and harvest, he spent much time in Pleasant View. This area and the area extending up through Weber High, the White Church Building, and the Indian Trail Subdivision were very popular grounds that the Indians traveled in earlier days. And in this area, many arrowheads and grinding stones and artifacts have been found over the years. A regular procedure in the early days when people left their homes to go would be to place a broom across the outside of the door as a sign to the Indians that no one was home. We invite you to listen to two true stories that follow.
Marianne was very frightened of Indians, and they would often come riding around the hill where they lived. One day when Wilford was helping his father on the farm, the Indians came riding to the gate. The chief dismounted and came to the house. Marianne took her two little babies, Marianne and Sarah Susan, into the back room. Then she carefully opened the door just a bit, to see the Indian grinning and pointing. She brought him bread, butter, and bacon, but he shook his head no and continued pointing. In desperation, she finally said, "Yes." With that, he yelled at the others, and they joined him in the watermelon patch, where they broke open melons and ate or destroyed every one of them.
About 1884, my grandmother, Eliza P. Reese, said, while living on the homestead on the pole patch, she and her husband, Charles A.H. Reese, were getting ready to go down to Sunday school in Pleasant View one Sunday when an Indian appeared at the door. Charles H. Reese had his face all well lathered up with soap preparatory to shaving. The Indian said, "Bread, woman, bread." He insistently repeated it, demanding some results. Just then, my grandfather turned to the Indian, showing his lathered face, and the Indian disappeared in a hurry. He probably had never seen a face like that before. He knew the white man had diseases and did not want to catch that one.
At the north end of 900 West is the area known as Pole Patch. This area got its name from Jesse Reed, James Rice, and John Johns. They lived near a patch of quaking aspen trees and used them for their log cabins. Other early settlers caught on to this idea and would often say that they were going to the pole patch to cut the logs that were necessary to build their homes. If you look through the fence, you will see a tumble of logs, and that is all that remains from one of the earliest schools in Pleasant View. To the west of this is the former home of Mac and Fay Wade. Prior to the Wades purchasing this home, it had been used during the days of Prohibition to make illegal whiskey. The lady of the house would sit at the window and watch for people to come up the lane. If she saw somebody, she would pull a string that was connected to cans in the barn that would make a racket and alert the people in the barn that somebody was coming. They would quickly cover up what they were doing. For many years, as Sheriff Wade worked this land, he would come across abandoned stills that had been used in the process of illegal whiskey making or bootlegging. As you drive from the top of 900 West to to the Red Church parking lot at the bottom, you will hear 6 minutes of amazing stories. May I add a word of caution in today's language? Don't even think about it. Enjoy.
Following our memories of Charles Rodney Cragen, going back to his early years in Pleasant View and the fun activities that took place when we did not have the availability of television and movies and all the entertainment that we do today. Times when entertainment was developed by spontaneous combustion, by people getting together and deciding what can we do that's fun. And of course, utilizing whatever Mother Nature had given us, whether it be a rainstorm, whether it be a fire, whether it be a snowstorm, whatever Mother Nature gave us, we were forced to try to use to have fun. Pleasant View was a great town to grow up in, probably as good a town as there is in anywhere in the world. Pleasant View was a place where people pulled together. They came from very difficult roots. They had been pioneer stock, and they were just solid, solid people. One of the fun memories I have of Pleasant View is the sleigh riding that took place. Being here on the fields in the north end of Weber County, the snow would lay down those thick blankets of snow across the front, and we would utilize it in many different ways. There were the toboggans, and there were the sleighs, and there were the inner tubes. And any time we could find a hill that had the right type of trajectory coming down off it, of course, that became the hill that was our sleigh riding hill. We had the added advantage, however, that we had the hills, the roadways that came up to Pleasant View. We had 1,100, we had 900, and then we had 500. 900 was the road that was kind of the most central because it went down through town and ended up down at the old church and across the street into the ballpark. It was rare that on a Saturday you did not find a group of kids out playing on the hill. And mothers and dads all jumped in to help give support. It was a long hill. It took a long ride to get up. So mothers and dads would come over hour after hour with their cars, and we as kids would go scooting down the hill on as fast as we could go on the sleighs. And then at the bottom, the mothers would come in, or dads would come in with their cars, and we'd drop a rope out behind the car, and somebody would hook the rope to the first of their sled, and somebody would grab the runners on the other sleds, and before long, you had this great big wave of people going back up the hill behind the car. Well, there were some great things that happened to that, great trips, great racing that took place on that kind of a format on a Saturday afternoon. There were a few sidelights that were kind of interesting as well. Obviously, the things we're talking about are not overly safe. And yet here we were out there interacting with the traffic, though not as much, of course, as it is today. And I don't recall that we've ever had a major accident that was life-threatening in all that playing around, but it sure could have been. There was one particular Saturday afternoon when people had met and been playing, and during the course of the afternoon, cars going up and down 900 had gotten their way too close to the edge, and there evidently had been a drainage line going down that way, so there was a hole underneath the snow, and the inner tube, sleighs could slide off into that, and as they did, the sleighs would stop suddenly. Well, one of these instances was my experience. We were coming down the hill at a great rate of speed, and I'll talk about speed in just a moment, but as we came down the hill at this great speed, I cut too close to the edge, and as I did so, my runner dropped off that ledge, and as it dropped off, my sleigh stopped suddenly. I was probably doing the neighborhood of 45 miles an hour, and I can remember flying through the air thinking I'm a dead man. As I hit the snow, I started to flip upside down and roll and bang, and I finally came to a rest. I just laid there and was sure that it wasn't anything not broken. I checked everything and found that I could move it. My face felt like somebody had just stuck it with a whole bunch of little picks in it. My face was just hurting and burning. What had actually happened is, as I stopped, I flew down the ice bank of the edge there, and I just kept plowing through it with my face, and so the face just literally was notched and etched to the point where later pictures showed that it looked like I had some type of a measles or whatever because my face was so chewed up. Talking about speed coming down the hill, that's kind of interesting. We found that the very most fast area of the hills along here, once they were developed, would be about from the strip, the Highline Canal on 900, to up just about Bob Stoyer's home. That was a stretch that you could run to get a start. We could go clear up to the crossroads, but it didn't seem like we ever got that much more speed. But a lot of times that's where parents turned around, so probably the most logical strip of road that we ran was part of the crossroads, and then go down and into the church. One Saturday afternoon, we had been slaying a lot, and some of the fellows that drove came in and said, we'll come back tonight, and let's do some runs in the night. It should be a lot of fun. And we said, of course. So as the night rolled on and they showed back up, we went out and started sleigh riding. But the road was so fast that we would get going down and we couldn't see what we were doing. And so the car's the friend, Kevin Stanley Barker, indicated that he would follow us with his car, keeping his lights on us at all times. So we started up on top, and as we got part way down, the car didn't stay with us, and we were on our own. And we were flying down that road to the point that I can remember the tears were just rolling out of our eyes. Not only did we go singly, but we went doubly on occasion. Can't even believe we did that, because it was just almost suicide, but we did. When we got to the bottom, and he finally showed up, he indicated that he had started off down the hill, got a little bit nervous because we were going too fast, so he went up into second gear, and he decided he was not going to go out of second gear. He was going to stay in second gear because he didn't want to have to deal with his brakes. He indicated to us that the last time he looked at the speedometer, we were doing about 55 miles an hour, and then we just disappeared out of sight. So I have no idea how fast we were going, but we had the ability to get tremendous speed.
As you leave the parking lot of the Red Brick Church, go west on Pleasant View Drive until you reach 1100 West. There you will turn right or north, and the second lot on your right, you will see the first brick home of James Jensen. This is one of the oldest structures still standing in Pleasant View. James Jensen was the owner of the first grocery store in Pleasant View. It was later known as the Jensen Wade Store. He also served as the first postmaster and was a successful fruit grower and shipper. As you look at this home, can you imagine that a family of 10 once lived here? Please return to Pleasant View Drive, continue west until you reach 1508 Pleasant View Drive. This home was built by Reuben T. Reese in 1903. He was known as the Honey King. He produced more than 100,000 pounds of honey each year. He had 3,500 colonies of bees and was the national president of the Honey Producers Association. This home was one of the finest homes in Pleasant View and for many years was the center for social gathering. If you continue west on Pleasant View Drive and come to the junction of Highway 89, you may stop at the Peter Skeen Ogden marker. Just slightly north and west of here are the hot springs. These were once a favorite spot for the Indians to camp. Many years ago, there was a thriving resort area here. It could accommodate 300 to 400 people at a time. The people would come from miles around for the curative powers of the water. There was dancing, there was a hotel with a dining area, and the railroad stopped here regularly. Now that you know where the hot springs were, please return to Pleasant View Park. On the way, there's a 5-minute story that you will want to know.
There were several of us young teenage boys in this small community who were full of life and always looking for adventure. One such spirited boy was my friend Tom Johns, who had seen his older brother Walter catch snakes. Walt had been bitten by one, but he had taken his knife and cut the bite open, sucked out the blood, and soon was fine. Tom thought that he could do like Walt had done. One day he managed, with a forked stick, to catch a rattler around the neck. He brought it down to our house and asked me to go with him out to the hot springs, about a mile west of where we lived, where he thought he could sell it to a Chinese doctor who said he used snake oil for medicine. On the way, we stopped at several homes to display the catch and show how brave Tom was. When we stopped at Thomas Budge's place, Tom held the snake on the doorstep, and it flipped its body around, making such a noise that Thomas Budge said, "Get that damn thing out of here." Tom picked it up, and on we walked. We reached the hot springs after dark, and the barroom was filled with men who worked on the railroad and at the farms around the neighboring towns. Tom walked right in the door and laid the snake on the center of the bar. The snake threw its body around and rattled so loud that it did not take but a couple of seconds before the barroom was left to Tom and the snake. It was clearly evident that no one wanted anything to do with it, not even the Chinese doctor or the Chinese cook. Of course, this was a big disappointment to Tom, and there was nothing left to do but start the walk back home. When we reached the big cottonwood tree in front of Herbert Reese's home, Tom was ready to stop and rest. He said to me, "You take the snake for a minute." I said, "To thunder with you. Not on your life will I take that snake." So after fooling around a while, he said, "The snake has bit me." I said, "Throw it down," and I decided to run to Chauncey Reese's place as fast as I could go. It was not easy for Tom to throw that snake down. He had to tear it loose first. Finally, he did get rid of it and followed me over to Chauncey's home, where they let us in. Tom asked Chauncey to cut a gash in his finger so that he could suck the blood out. Chauncey only said, "Cut it yourself." So Tom pretended he was cutting and trying to get some blood out, but I never saw any blood. We walked on up the street as far as William Barker's. When they heard Tom's story, they became very concerned. We were only teenage boys, but Tom had been going with William Barker's daughter, Amy. When she heard about Tom, she wanted to get the doctor right then. But Tom made excuses, saying he was all right. Finally, we got a lantern close enough to him, as he was lying on the floor now. We could see that he was really swelling up. I ran as fast as I could to my Uncle Wilson Cragen's home, as I knew he had the only telephone in town in his grocery store. His house was dark, and everyone had gone to bed. I knocked hard on the door, and he answered. When I told him about Tom, he said, "I knew that snake would kill that kid when I saw him with it. But I begged so hard for him to let me phone the doctor that he gave in and went with me to the store. When I got Dr. Joyce on the phone and told him Tom was dying, he said he would come as fast as he could. He rode his horse, as that was his only means of transportation. He ran his horse as hard as he could and made the 10 miles from Ogden to Pleasant View in 25 minutes. June Wade heard about Tom and went to tell his father, Bishop Edward Wade, who lived about a mile to the east. He had Tom brought to his home. Boys stopped the doctor as he came by, and Dr. Joyce worked all night over Tom, who was swollen up like a toad. Finally, the swelling began to go down. As the sun was coming up, the doctor said that Tom was out of danger, and soon the doctor left for home. Tom's finger that had been bitten by the rattler was always funny looking, almost like a snake's head, and it stayed that way as long as Tom lived.
When you have returned to Pleasant View Park, you have an additional 6 minutes of stories to follow. This was once home to a church, a school. It was a stop on the Pony Express. There was also a stage stop here. And did you know that Pleasant View also once had its own streetcar? Thank you for your interest today. When you are finished, please remember to return this tape to the city offices. Thank you, and happy birthday, Pleasant View.
A great, great memory growing up involving membership pulling together, membership accomplishing great things, involved the building of the church that we have at the end of 900. As a boy growing up, I was privileged to attend the old Pioneer Building that was down where this building is, having the old square rectangle recreational center out back, a little concrete reservoir to help hold water to water around the church, help take care of water for the stock that people would bring to church. But anyway, this opportunity came, and in those days, when you went to build a new building, the members had to do and contribute and raise the money. And it wasn't something where we just build a building and had Salt Lake buy it for us. We actually went out and had to have fundraisers and projects and build a building. So when it came time to tear it down, of course, the manpower was critical because that would save that money, which would be spent otherwise, to allow it to be put into the building. And so it was just night after night, week after week, of activities at the new building site, getting ready for the building, laying the concrete, etc. Well, this required a great deal of time, and because the church was not paying for it, they wanted the members to pay for it. It gave us even more time than we had to deal with. What are we going to do while the church is torn down? Two of the farmers in town, both happening to be related to me, one was my grandpa and one was my dad, had large packing sheds that we used for fruit production. Now, these packing sheds were not elaborate. They were just concrete shells that had a roof on them, and they were nice, but they certainly weren't designed to be waterproof totally. They weren't designed to be temperature controlled at all. And so they were approached by the bishopric and the stake leaders if it's possible that they could use these two structures to help hold church. Well, to my knowledge, without a bat and a blinking of an eye, my dad and my grandpa relinquished their sheds for some period of time. And historians who are more accurate with these details will have to tell you how long that is. But I recall it was certainly at least a year and maybe longer. Well, now this was a year meeting in a shed that did not have any type of flooring except just some gravel, no major doors except just big pieces of carpeting that was taken up. And yet we survived and the members did real well. Summer months were fun because in summer months we'd go out on the lawn and meet underneath the tree and have our lesson, and we'd have our socials out on the lawn, and it was a marvelous, marvelous time. But when you were trying to get things done and stay on track and trying to do it in with a furnace roaring in the main chamber and cold upstairs and cold over in the corners, and you're divided out within that structure to make it through, it was a tough ordeal. But for us as kids, that just represented one more of those great, great memories and great traditions that were being made. It was a wonderful experience as we saw that building start to come to fruition, and we saw the walls going up, and we saw all these things take place, to think that we could take it and do it ourselves and have it be completed so nicely. Now, I'm sure there were elements of the building that were done by others and by professionals, but we certainly can state claim that we did a great deal of work on that building as a part of our priesthood donation. During one summer, after we had moved into the new church that now has been renovated many, many times down at the end of 900, we were sitting back in the overflow, and the bishop got up and indicated that we had a crisis on our hands, indicated that there was a fire raging out on the Hunts Rock area, and Hunts Rock area is that area out above Evergreen Pines. I think that's the name of it anyway. And why there was such a concern, I don't know, because that was above the water line that we had to irrigate, but the bishop was very concerned about it, and as they discussed it in priesthood meeting, it was determined that it was more appropriate than to sit and worry about it, is to go home and change our clothes and go out on the field and work to try to put the fire out. So, interestingly enough, right during priesthood meeting, after opening exercises, everybody went home, they changed into their clothes, got their buckets and their wet burlap, and we went out there and formed this big, long, long line chasing the fire up the hill, which we did do, and which we got out. But I've always been impressed that here the bishop had a crisis on his hands, and he was able to put out the plea immediately. He had the kind of people to reach out to help. And it was a memory I can't describe very well, because it happened probably back when I was, probably 12. I had to have been a deacon, because I was at priesthood meeting. So long time ago, but a great, great, great story.